When we were children, three little children in the back seat, you know how children torment each other, and there would always be, my father would turn around, he'd divide the back seat up into three spaces, but my brother, who always had to challenge everything, he declared that the air didn't belong to anyone. Maybe he got my father to agree. So, you know, you got to be, you could encroach as long as you didn't actually touch. So you'd lie on your back and you'd extend your feet, or you'd sit. I can still just remember the picture of my brother's feet coming in right at my face. And how small must you have been? And he would always be, he would just cry, air is free, he would cry out. So maybe that's where you develop your sense of these things. When I used to travel and speak, we'd have to set it up every time. David would do it. Wherever he would put the microphone, I would pull it back about 4 inches away from people. I mean, it was just like, it didn't make any difference, but there would just always be this little gesture to just back up just a little bit until I realized I was doing it. Then I stopped. But I would always, like, it would feel to me like it was just a little too close, so I'd back it up. And then I began to see how absurd it was. Odd, you know? Okay, last week we had a very interesting discussion about the first page of the festival. And because unlike a lot of the things that we've worked with, you all have really immersed yourself in this. So it was a great deal of fun. So let's go on and see if we can go from here. We can try to go through the bird story tonight and see how far we get. There's copies of the festival over there if you want one to look at. Yeah, because then you'll know what we're dealing with. Okay. So I'll read a few paragraphs. Are there any comments or questions from last week before we go on from the first page? No? Okay. Nina sent me 10 dictionary definitions of the word redemption, which I didn't bring with me, but it was interesting. You did. Okay, do we want to go back to redemption? I was assuming you wouldn't, and I was surprised you didn't raise your hand, so I did it for you.
Well, I was going to say that having had the class last week, working with the definitions, and then having the opportunity to listen to Swami do Sunday service, struck me entirely different. And all the hackles that I used to get up didn't happen.
Oh, that's good.
So I think this is perfect.
Right. I'll read you just the definitions because they were interesting. Redeem and redemption. Recovery of something pawned or mortgaged. The payment of an obligation. Deliverance upon payment of ransom or rescue. Theological definition is salvation from sin through Jesus' sacrifice. To recover ownership of by paying a specified sum, like the green stamps. To fulfill, to set free, to rescue or to ransom again. To save from a state of sinfulness and its consequences. Which is actually interesting because that's two different things, isn't it? A state of sinfulness and its consequences. To restore the honor, worth, or reputation of. For example, you botched up the last job, but you can redeem yourself on this one. So,
or an incarnation.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so that seemed like a lot of fun. Okay. So, I was going to start reading. Any other questions on that? Redemption was a big word. It's been a big word for all of us, I think. So let's go on. A fledgling bird once flew out into the world. Gain strength and wisdom, its parents told it. And what you acquire, share with others, even as we have shared with you. For you are a part of all that is. Thus, Lord, we left you, countless eons ago. Ours was a holy mission. You charged us to learn great lessons from life. To be fruitful in the gifts you had given us, to expand and multiply them. Alas, we abandoned our mission. Instead, we hoarded selfishly. Nor did wisdom come to us when, repeatedly, we lost everything we had. For the young bird in flight for the first time gloried in its newfound strength. It began to think, how foolish I would be to share my strength with anyone. What else is wisdom if not to keep what is mine for myself? And so we, like that bird, entered upon the second stage of the soul's long journey away from its home in God, the stage which is called the revolt. So, as you know, no doubt know by this time, the little bird's journey goes through four stages. The first stage is the mission, and the second stage is the revolt. I've spent a lot of time without actually analyzing the words here for a moment, but I have observed in a great deal of interactions with people over the years, and including myself, that oftentimes the root cause of people's emotional distress about the circumstances of their lives is that they are in a fundamental state of rebellion against the way life is. Whether it's specifically this circumstance, or even very often in just a sort of a general sense, there's this underlying fundamental attitude of I don't want to accept the way it is. I don't even want to know the way it is. I'm just going to be against the way it is. Sort of like I'm mad that I ended up on this planet at all, as if somebody had done it to you. So Swamiji's starting this out by sort of explaining that the intention of God was full of grace. But also the intention of God, we were set out on this mission, but the mission is that he, what you acquire, share with others. You charged us to learn lessons from life, to be fruitful in the gifts you had given us, to expand and multiply them. Now what that implies, however, is that a great deal of effort and energy is required on our part. So sometimes we think that the original mission from God was somehow a passive one. And I think that's where the state of rebellion comes in, that it isn't passive. He gave us the gift of life and all the potential to be an instrument of the Spirit, really. That's the gift that God has given us, is the gift of divine love. I mean, that's the fundamental gift. And that's what we're supposed to expand and multiply. But the effort to expand and multiply that requires great discipline on our part and requires that we attune ourselves to that divine spirit. And that was the general assumption. But we started thinking more in terms of what is coming into us. And once we start thinking about what's coming in, we also start thinking about what's not coming in. And so we begin to hoard. And as soon as you begin to hoard, you begin to count. Whenever it's just flowing, you're not counting anything. It's just coming in, it's going out, it's coming in, it's going out. But as soon as you start holding it, then you start thinking about what you do and you don't have. It's very interesting. Sometimes if people have no money at all, they're very free. But when they get a moderate amount of money, they begin to think about it. You get a small inheritance. Whereas you had nothing in the bank before and felt perfectly relaxed, when you get a small inheritance, you begin to become anxious about every penny that you spend. It's a strange sort of reality when suddenly there's a little bit. So we may think ourselves free, but we really just haven't been tested yet. But we start out and the project of life is too much, so we revolt against it. Does that make sense? Are there any comments or questions? I love also what it says, nor does wisdom come to us when repeatedly we lost everything we had. Isn't that just like... And that happens to us over and over. And at the very least, it happens just because we lose our bodies. We lose our youth, and then we lose our lives over and over and over again. I've often joked with women friends who are contemporaries with me as we discuss the various aspects of not being as young as we used to be. And I think, how many millions and millions of times has this happened? I mean, I'm just astonished. First, I'm astonished that one bothers to notice or comment, but that there is actually any sense of concern about it. It's just, it's beyond comprehension to me, but I can't deny that it's there. There's just this awareness. A woman friend was telling me recently that she was sorting through pictures, and she came to a picture of herself when she was much younger and much more beautiful in her own eyes than she is now. And all of a sudden, she was just sobbing uncontrollably. Just sort of for the loss of her, as she put it, of her face and her figure. And I mean, she herself knew it was folly. But the interesting thing, just as a little bit about that, in the astral world, they say you have a body that's, you know, in your mid-20s. So there's sort of like this affection for youth that we remember. So maybe it's a memory of the astral world. Maybe that's the slight justification for it. But I don't know what it is. But nonetheless, nor does wisdom come to us when repeatedly we lost everything we had. And however you define it, Swamiji makes the has made the comment many times, Master too, that no matter what happens in all of your cycles of up and downs, of waves, it's all got to neutralize. Every time everything goes well, it's just a wave on the ocean, and by definition, it's going to go down again. That the sum total of all your striving to make it really work in this world is going to be zero. That every success will be met by a failure, and every failure will be met by success, and you'll work and work and work to hold it on one side, and inevitably it's going to go to nothing. Nor did wisdom come to us when repeatedly we lost everything we had. It's the strangest thing, isn't it? But there it is. And it's also worthwhile, because even though the fourth stage, you know, comes much later after we go through this for a while, to just really contemplate what was our original mission from God. To be fruitful in the gifts that God had given us, to expand and multiply them, and then to share with others as God has shared with us. You might have noticed in our newsletter this time we had that silly little poem, and it, you know, the essence of it was in a rhyme, so it was better than this, but it was, "Oh, you're asking me to give again?" The devotee says, "How long must this go on?" And then the angel answers, "Only as long as God gives to you. As soon as he stops giving to you, you get to stop too." It was a very silly poem, but it was a very good answer. You know, God has given to us, and we somehow think that we can just stop and keep, whether it's money or enthusiasm or kindness or, you know, just every good thing that God gives you. He doesn't give it to you just to hoard it. He gives it to you so you can pass it on. And if you stop, you lose. Over and over again you lose, because the very definition of what you have changes, you see? That's why you lose. You don't ever really lose God's love, but if you define it incorrectly, then you lose it, you see? If you define it as something that belongs to the ego, then you have to lose it. But if you just define it for what is, then it's always there. Yes.
So the closer you get to not defining things by the ego, there'll be less of this probably, and it'll be more of this.
Well, you'll live. The waves may still happen depending on how much past karma you have, but you will experience them completely differently. See, what makes the wave go up and down is you're riding it to the tip and abandoning the base. I often draw the picture of the base of a tree with all the branches out like this, and all of us have the base of the tree, and we all of us have these branches. If your self-definition is the base of the tree, you can extend yourself all the way out to the tiniest leaf at the end of the branch, but if something happens to that leaf, it doesn't happen to you, really. Whereas if you walk out to the end of the branch and set up your reality at the end of the branch and abandon your source, and then something happens to that branch, you have nothing under you. It just simply collapses, and you feel like you have collapsed. Now, does the tree living at its source manifest fewer branches? Not necessarily. Does the devotee living in the consciousness of the ocean have fewer waves? Not necessarily. Depends on your past karma. But you experience them differently. That's like when people say to Swamiji, "Oh, you've had so many trials and obstacles in your lives." "Your life," he says, "have I?" It's just like, to him, it's not, other people will see these great problems coming. He doesn't see them as big waves going up and big waves going down. He just sees them as his progress through life. And if other people see it as waves, he doesn't see it that way. He's identified with the center reality. And so with us, hoarding it is when all those bits and pieces come, we start trying to grab them in instead of just letting it pass through us and continuing to just move through in the spirit of freedom in which we were created. Now, this is tricky because this does not mean being uninvolved. You see, some people will try to keep their freedom by never committing themselves. And oftentimes you get this slight confusion about what is spiritual. "Well, I don't ever want to be attached," people will say. But their lack of willingness to commit is what they're actually attached to then is fear. And it's not really that they're free, it's that they haven't even begun to be free. And that's why the example set by the masters is so important for us to understand what this really looks like. So you see Paramhansa Yogananda, who just gave every ounce of his life blood to start Self-Realization Fellowship. And, you know, that's the disciples who are still part of that organization. They talk all the time about, you know, how much effort and energy he put out to establish it, and he did. I mean, he was also doing many other things at the same time, but he didn't hesitate to commit. He didn't hesitate to buy the property and pay the mortgage and, you know, take the lake shrine and completely remodel it and build the towers and set up the Gandhi Memorial and set up the Encinitas. I mean, he just was always making things happen. He was totally committed to the task given to him, which was to take the gifts that God had given him and to expand and multiply them and then to share them with others. That is the mission. The mission isn't to sort of cover yourself in Teflon and see if you can scoot through. You see, there's a great deal of difference. You're still in a state of revolt if that's what you're doing. Swamiji was remarking once that, talking about just himself, he was saying, you know, sometimes people think that I'm less detached than I am because, essentially how he put it, he says, I'm so detached I can be committed. And he talks about Master too. Master was so free that Master didn't have to have any barriers with the world around him because there was nothing that drew him in the world, and therefore he could enter into it completely. Now, of course, there are states of renunciation in which, stages of renunciation in which we do withdraw our involvement deliberately. I mean, people go into monasteries and become brahmacharis. I mean, that's a very real thing to do. But nonetheless, it's not done properly, it's not a narrowing of consciousness. It's simply a discarding of the lesser to embrace the greater. And inside, it's expansive. If it's done in an immature way, it's contractive. But that's not really what the intention of it is. Does that make sense? So, it was interesting. I was talking to David the other night about some people I know, several different families, on the periphery of our community, not people that all of you would know, but people that are connected more through us. You know, going through, in several instances, just totally unexpected, really, you know, just tragic things, deaths and disappointments with children and, loss of home and family, money, all the kinds of things people are attached to. And in all cases, there's a degree of spirituality and a degree of courage going through it. But I was saying, it's not as if our community burned down or if my marriage broke up or if David died unexpectedly or, you know, I was hit by a car and became paralyzed, you know, all the things that you can imagine happening, that I would just sail into it without a blip. There's just no, that would be completely absurd to suggest that I would have that kind of power. But nonetheless, we have lived our whole lives with the expectation that everything will go away anyway. And so even though we're involved in it, we haven't like defined our lives as many people do in terms of just getting it together. You know, this is my house, this is where I raised my children, you know, I'll stay in this house and then my children will bring their grandchildren and then I'll help raise my grandchildren. I mean, like that being like the definition of life, that's what I'm going to do. And the man has earned the money and he's made financial security and all of these different things, which are not necessarily the wrong things for people to have done. But for us, even to the extent that we're doing them, we're always doing them with one part of our mind knowing that any moment it could just go away. And so if it does go away, one has the challenge of disappointment. But one never really thinks that it wasn't going to happen. Do you know what I mean? Like on a real fundamental level? Or that the purpose of life wasn't to take it all away from me. I remember, especially when I was living as a renunciate, as a nun, formally, in the more traditional monasticism, and I had this teensy, tiny trailer with no running water and no amenities at all, except for a heater, which was, I never tried to live below the level of having a heater. Uma and I were discussing that recently. She actually tried to live once or twice without a heater. I never tried to live without a heater. In fact, I created a love song to my heater. It was just like really, it was my one really, really strong possession in life was to have a heater. I mean, it snowed, it was cold there. But I realized that as so many people think in terms of acquisition as they grow older, you know, that as life goes on that they will acquire more. And my mental picture was that as life would go on, I would have less and less. And you know, that even the little that I had, would even that would become irrelevant to me. I mean, that was the hope that I had. That's why it was such a challenge for me to take on a householder's life in certain ways, because the whole dynamic of it shifted a little bit. But that's understanding, because it's not hoarding. Even if it's given to you, even if you have it, even if you accumulate it, that's not the same as hoarding it. Hoarding it is a state of mind. And if you hoard, you lose. And then we think we didn't hoard efficiently enough. Nor did wisdom come to us when repeatedly it lost everything it had. So you ask yourself, how many times does this have to happen before I'll stop doing it? And you know, it gets subtle. You may not be attached to money or your home or any of those things, but then you get attached to your self-image, people loving you, being approved by others, being understood, being recognized. I mean, you know, it's a big long list. We're always hoarding something. That's just the way it is. All right? So, the bird tells us, if you're hoarding it, you're going to lose it. There you got it. And if you're hoarding it, you're in revolt against the divine, and it's not going to work out for you. Okay, so we, like that little bird, entered upon the second stage of the soul's long journey. That bird's brief day was like eons of our time. When afternoon came, it entered a storm cloud, and soon found itself struggling for its life. Wind and rain lashed at its wings. The more it fought back, the weaker it became. "Give yourself into my hands," cried the wind. "To your strength I can then add my own." At last, the little bird heeded this counsel. Then, suddenly, it found itself soaring joyously, high above the clouds. Well, that's the whole story there, isn't it, too? You know, Swamiji, I think I mentioned this in the first class, Swamiji said, this line, "a fledgling bird once flew out into the world," just came into his head at this stage of writing the festival. And he had no idea where it was going, and he thought it was kind of wacky, like there's the P.G. Woodhouse story about the hard-bitten mystery writer whose aunt writes these glutinous? No, that's not the right word. But treacly love stories, and she dies and wills her cottage to her nephew, the hard-bitten detective writer, with a certain allowance, an annual allowance, but he must live in the cottage because she's hoping that the influence of the cottage will help him to soften his ways. It's called Honeysuckle Cottage. It's one of the P.G. Woodhouse's funniest. So he goes there, and he tries to write his hard-bitten detective novels, but all these frail young girls keep wandering into his story. You know, he's writing along, and then suddenly a girl inserts herself into the story, and, you know, he has this dialogue with his typewriter. Where did she come from? And she's coming from the atmosphere of the cottage. Well, having said all of that, which is a very long thing, Swami said when the little bird came into this, he sort of felt a little bit like the writer in Honeysuckle Cottage, like, where is this bird coming from? But he just trusted it and just went forward, and then this whole story unfolded. And it's a very real image of this little bird just kind of going off and trying to fly. We can all see it. We can all see the little fledgling bird sort of setting out and eventually becoming a full-grown creature capable of whatever is asked of it from this little fledgling beginnings. So then after a time, that storms come, which is that life is never smooth sailing. And so he found himself feeling like he was struggling for his life, because he's this little fledgling bird, and the wind and rain lashed at its wings, and the more it fought back, the weaker it became. Now, isn't that just the way it is? The current starts taking you in a certain direction, all the ways that we were describing, whatever may be happening. Things just don't go the way you expected them to go. We manifest often from, even within ourselves, we have ambitions that we want to fulfill, or dreams or ideas of how we're going to run our lives, and then things just don't happen. Wind and rain lash at our wings. And what are our wings? Our wings are the ability to go forward, to soar, to move in freedom, to direct our lives in the way we want to direct it. And we're trying to use that part of ourselves which we think we're in control of, but instead we get pelted and beaten. And the more we resist those forces, the more we try to assert our own small will against this greater current, we just wear ourselves out. You know, we just beat against it, and we can't make it any different. We just have to ride with it. And so that's what finally they say, the more it fought back, the weaker it became. The more it resisted where life was taking it, the less strength he had. So then the wind gives him a clue. Just relax. Give your, you know, give yourself into my hands. Now, of course, that's a very scary question, isn't it? Give yourself into my hands. This is a storm we're talking about. We're not talking about like a spring zephyr. We're talking about something that's been, that feels like it's really beating you up. And but the wind itself, that which is beating you, says, just relax. Go with where I'm going, and you'll find that it's much easier. And then it even says, to your strength I can add my own, meaning whatever willpower you're using, if you use it to go with the current of life instead of against the current of life, then you'll be swimming all the faster. I often talk to people when we're talking about the chakras and just how you work out karma in general, that once you really try to go toward the light, once you have the inclination to try to go toward God, even if it feels like a very small effort, or even if you can't really rationally figure out how this effort's going to bring the result you actually need, if you start, once you're going with the current, there's always a whole lot more energy than you expect there to be. Then once you start going with the current, then you have not only the own effort of flapping your wings, but the wind also blowing you. At last, the little bird heeded this counsel. And there's always that, I love these little phrases, at last. There's another phrase in here, after a time. But at last, you know, at last implies that there's a tremendous amount of effort not to go with it before you actually go with it. But how many times in our lives have we just resisted what life was asking of us? I mean, a story that you all have heard me tell many times of my trying to, being very emotionally confused about what God wanted of me, and Swamiji just answering me so directly when I said, it's so hard to know what God wants, and he said, no, it's not. And I went through a whole cycle with that, but it was exactly that. It was that the wind and rain were lashing at my wings, and I just was determined that I was going to direct the course of my life differently than the course of my life was going. And as a result, I was in a state of complete emotional turmoil, and I just didn't know how I could... there's another delusion in there, which is when you're fighting so hard and you're being beaten back all the time, you sort of don't know, you don't know how you could survive. You feel like you can't survive, and you don't realize, that's why the second part of that, if you surrender to me, then my strength will be your strength. And so often when you can't fight back anymore, sometimes it's because we're just too weak to fight back, and suddenly we allow ourselves to be taken by the current, and we suddenly feel all this strength coming into us. Let me say it another way. We think we can't do what God is asking us to do, but when we actually try to do it, then we find that God's strength helps us do it. But he can't help us do that which is not taking us toward the light. We often talk about that. Sometimes if you're not getting answers to your prayers, it's because you're praying for something that he's not interested in giving you. Right? And so he won't help you. I'll never forget, this is like one of those, I don't have really vivid memories of much of my childhood, but odd things stand out. Like I remember the sister of a friend of mine who was just so vacuous in her brain, talking about how every night she prayed that God would make her a cheerleader. And my friend and I, you know, just both just like, if the desire to be a cheerleader was a little hard for us to comprehend in the first place, just being who we were. I know some of people that I love and admire were cheerleaders, so I won't really say anything specific. But it was hard for me to relate to. But I sensed somehow that it would be hard for God to relate to also. You know, that just like, why would he make you a cheerleader? It just seemed like such an odd thing for God to be interested in. But a lot of times that's what's happening, is that we're trying so hard to do something that is not in our best interests, often because we're trying to prevent ourselves from having to face and deal with something that is in our best interests, often because we imagine that we won't have the strength to do that. You know, trying to hold together a situation that really needs to be let go because we just don't know how we could cope if we lost this job or lost this investment or lost this relationship or whatever, or, you know, or our children went a direction we didn't want them to go, or any of those things. So we fight so hard against it, not knowing that sometimes if we go with it, then the wind will give us the strength to go with it, strength that we didn't think we'd have to cope. Does that make sense? And so after a time, at last in this case, at last, the little bird heeded this counsel. They love this use of words. You heed the counsel. You know, it didn't say that he totally embraced the concept or even that he understood. He just heeded the counsel. It's very subtle. At last, the little bird totally understand that if he went with the wind, then the wind would carry him and he would be safe and he knew everything was fine. None of that. He just heeded the counsel. Okay, I'll just surrender. That's all the counsel was, surrender. Then suddenly, it found that all the suffering was self-imposed. And that this has to relate with calm acceptance and joy. Whereas in the past, suffering and sorrow was what we thought we had to do. Now all of a sudden, it's just he calmly accepts it. And so suddenly he's lifted above the clouds. He's not necessarily lifted above the test and trial, but because the storm may still be going on. It's also subtle there. Underneath the clouds, it could still be raining. But he's above it now. He's floating on something else, and he might have to deal with all the water still, but he floats above it. Hours passed, and night fell. Then the little bird grew afraid, because now it's dark. And now he cannot see where he's going. How, it cried, can I fly in this darkness? And the night whispered, fear not, for lo, peace awaits you in the unknown. Surrender to me, there's that word again, surrender to me, and your strength will be renewed. And after a time, the tiny rebel surrendered and found the night's counsel true. That's one of my favorite little sections in there. Yeah, obviously. The other part of it is when you think about night, he says, how can I fly in darkness? And then what he's asked to surrender to is the unknown. You see, the test becomes more subtle. Because oftentimes we'll say, oh, well, I would cooperate completely if I just understood. We often say that. If we just busy explain to me, then I would do it. It's one of the mind's favorite tricks. If I just had it all laid out and could be totally secure in my ego, then I would cooperate with God. But how can I fly in this darkness? Well, that's a very good question, isn't it? How can I fly when I have no idea where I'm going? I just know that this is the way God is taking me, but I have no idea where it's leading. How can I do that? And then it says, peace awaits you in the unknown. And that there is that sort of point in our lives. One of the mottos of Ananda that really holds Ananda together is, where there is Dharma, there is victory. And it's an extremely important concept, because a great deal of the time in our lives, and it's directly related to this one, a great deal of times, we really have no idea where we're going, and we have no idea what the consequences are, and we simply cannot see beyond the step in front of us. And so you use that simple concept, where there is Dharma, there is victory, which is, if I act with right consciousness and right action in the moment, it will work out. Many, many, many times, you really have no idea how it's going to work out. But you simply do the right thing as best you can right now with the absolute certainty that it will work out. And it always does. Because where there is Dharma, there is victory. Sometimes I remember one case of one woman who had gotten herself into so much financial trouble and tax trouble. And I mean, just, you know, beyond the beyond. And she had no capacity to earn a fraction of what she had to earn. So we just talked about it, and I told her that there's a concept that I use, which is beyond where there's Dharma, there's victory, which is what I call doing your Dharma in a vacuum, which is, there is no logical relationship between the actions you are taking and the problems that you're trying to solve, but you have no access to solutions that are going to actually solve your problems. So just right here and right now, in the vacuum is a vacuum of understanding or logical relationship. You just behave dharmically right now. You know, even if it's like putting $5 toward your $300,000 debt, you just put whatever it might be into that reality, and it will work out one way or another. This is a lot of the justification that we offer people all the time for tithing, which is that you just tithe 10% of whatever you earn, and that's your Dharma. And then the rest of it will work out. And people will say, but I can't afford it, you know, but I'll do it later when I have more money. But if I do that, I won't have money for this, or I'm so low on money, I better not do it now. But it's always, I just always shake my head. It's like, look, do it first. I mean, this is what you do first, which is you do that which is right first. And then everything else will follow after that. And that's that unknown. That's why I'm always trying to get people to understand. I talk about tithing whenever I can find a reasonable entry into it. Because money is such a big deal to everyone. And even people who are so, like, devoted to the spiritual path. Anything you want, God, absolutely anything. I'll do anything you want, except deal with my money in relationship to the divine. And I think, well, huh, oh, what do you know? This is a bit like concrete. It's really easy to talk about all your faith and what you'll do. And one of the things about tithing that's so powerful is that it really does put you right up against it. It tests you in the cold light of day, and it asks you the question in a very real sense, well, how much faith do I really have? And more than that, it actually gives you something to do. It gives you something to do that stretches you a little bit. And that's why 10%, I mean, sometimes we say, oh, you can do 2% or 3%, but quite frankly, you should do 10%. Because 2% or 3% is some kind of a compromise with, I mean, better that than nothing, and far better that than nothing at all, because you can't face 10. But that's also just do what's right. Step into the unknown. How can I pay my bills if I do this? Well, I don't know how you can pay your bills. But peace awaits you in that great sphere of trust. But you have to also do it wholeheartedly. You know, you can't do it. You have to do it because it's the mission we're in. To be fruitful in the gifts God has given us and to expand and multiply them. And if we start hoarding for ourselves, we're going to end up in these storm clouds. And if we start resisting the storm clouds, we're going to get lashed to pieces. And if it gets dark and we want to quit, what are we going to do? It's going to be dark anyway, folks. Peace awaits you in the unknown. All this freedom when you just trust in God, and that's the piece that it talks about. It's the gradual surrender of your own sense of how you're going to run it. So, after a time, the tiny rebel, I also love the picture. Don't you enjoy being the tiny rebel? You're just sort of there against the whole universe. I mean, of course, this is about this little fledgling bird, but nonetheless, sometimes you're just this little thing, sort of shaking your fist at the universe, trying to make sure that it conforms to you. There's a wonderful story about a young boy, he's now a grown man, but when he was a tiny child, about 3, he was such a handful, and he lived at the house we had in San Francisco, which was this 5-story, 45-room mansion with this huge wooden staircase that ran through the middle of the house, and it had all these hardwood floors, and all of that was beautiful, but the sound was just awful. I mean, if you were up in the upper story in your bedroom and someone opened the front door, you could hear it echo through the house. And this little boy, about 2 a.m., he had just had it. He was wide awake and nothing really interesting was going on, and he just got out of his bed and he stood right in the middle of the house at the top of the stairs, shouted at the top of his lungs, "I want it to be morning!" And he woke up the whole house, of course. It did no good whatsoever, but he had the satisfaction of expressing his desires. Very often I think of us, you know, just standing at the top of the staircase in the middle of the night demanding that the sun rise hours before its appointed hour. One of my friends, her little boy was inclined to have tantrums. And when he would have tantrums, she'd often lock him in his room. And she locked him in his room, latched it from the outside, and he was banging and yelling for a while, and then it got very quiet. She unlatched the door, and she said, "Sweetheart, are you done?" And he looked very thoughtful for a moment, and he said, "Not quite, Mother." So she latched him in, and he yelled and, you know, made noise for a little while longer. You know, that sort of isn't it that way sometimes? You're just like, I think I've told you once, I was having a snit about something, and I was so irritated, and I was so unhappy, and I was just dumping all this stuff and explaining it to David, how this was wrong and that was wrong and this was impossible and that was impossible. Just right in the middle, I said, "This is so stupid, I don't even believe it." And I just stopped. It's just like, oh, honey, get real. Like, what is the, are you done? Yes, I think I am done. Let's just go on with it. Okay. And then, are there any comments or questions? Nobody's raising their hand, so I'm okay. And rain and sky and grassy fields all sang, "Behold, your very strength to fly has never been your own, you nitwit. Look to the source of all power." It's implied, isn't it? Every time I read it, I try to think, now, do you say this with compassion? Or do you say this with sarcasm? You know, I figure that God would be compassionate. "Your very strength to fly, dear, has never been your own. Look to the source of all power if you would conquer fear and weakness." And also, that's a wonderful phrase. If you look to the source of power, if you would conquer fear and weakness. We've never used the words fear and weakness until right now, have we? But suddenly we realize that's what we're dealing with all the way through. Weakness of will, lack of determination, and fear of the unknown. Fear was there earlier. Fear not, he says. But it's also, he uses the word here, conquer. It isn't just a question of coping with or escaping from or just repressing until it's over or getting out of the tough circumstances. He says to conquer fear and weakness. How do you conquer that? You look to the source of all power. And you simply realize that we are made of the substance of creation. What is there to be weak and fearful about? You know, the ego is such a clever devil. It just is constantly throwing up these realities to us that we have all these reasons to be fearful and to be weak. A friend of ours is in the Stanford Hospital dying of cancer now, and he wasn't manifestly a spiritual person, but he's dying a heroic death. I'm so impressed. And I went to see him today, and I just sort of said, "How are you?" And he said, "I am separating myself from the world now." Just as calmly as could be. "I'm separating myself from the world." He didn't even say gradually. And he was just utterly calm. You know, all fear, all weakness. It just, in the great moment of need, he was just tuned into the source. And what was there to be afraid of? It's over. Life has been done. Let's just go on and do the next phase of it. I mean, that's not an attitude that comes without some struggle. But that's what we want to conquer. We want to be able... And this goes right back to it. Whereas in the past, suffering and sorrow was the coin of our redemption, which was how we got out of the ego state and back into the divine state. Whereas we used to think it was all about suffering and sorrow, now it's about calm acceptance and joy. And that's the same, that's the positive statement of conquering fear and weakness. Where does calm acceptance and joy come from? Because we feel that we have the strength to deal with it and we're not afraid. I mean, what makes you not accept things? Because you think you can't cope with them and they frighten you. I mean, what keeps us from feeling joyful? Because we think we can't cope and that frightens us. How do we conquer fear and weakness? How do we redeem ourselves then with calm acceptance and joy? By looking to the source of our power, which is not our own little wings, but which is all of these forces of the world. And so then, and the bird asks, and the bird finally asks an intelligent question. This is the first time the bird gets in the game, right? Until now, he's been having all this suffering and they've been giving him advice and finally he heeds it. But now he asks the question, where can I find this source? Because enough has happened to him and they're telling him now, you don't have to suffer like this. You have an alternative if you find this power. Well, where is the power? And you can see he's transitioned to a certain stage where he's coming out of the revolt, which you'll see in just a moment, which is the quest. And they answered, "Seek it in the farthest depths of being, in your own self." Now this is again Swamiji's saying that anybody who comes into this mandir for even one Sunday service will find out everything that our teaching is about. Where do I find this source? Seek it in the depth of your own being, in your own self. Now we're more or less accustomed to that idea, but you have to realize that's extraordinarily radical. You know, for a church to say, because what instead of saying, accept Jesus Christ and he'll save you, become a member of this church, none of those things. Just look to your own being. And so this is a sort of razor's edge that Ananda is walking, which is that we are not really anything of the form that you see. The form is merely a way to contain a reality that is formless. Or contain isn't the right word, but to define the space so that people can discover it. Because it's necessary in this uncongenial environment that we live in to draw a circle around this reality and concentrate it so that people can understand it. Because even you hear it, someone says, look to the source of your own being, that's where your power is. It goes over your head for a long time. And even if we know it, it goes out of our head a lot. So here we have this whole story of this bird struggling. Look to the source of, look to that power. Where do I find that power? Inside yourself. That's where that power is. Thus, gradually, the bird entered the third stage of its journey, which is called the quest. And that stage begins when he asks a question of the universe around him and says, "You tell me what's true." Prior to that, it was, what else is wisdom if not to keep what is mine for myself? You know, the mission was there, but I'm not going to follow this mission. What do they know? You know, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. But finally, enough happens. He asks a question, an answer is given. So now you move into the second stage, which is you're not established. We're not established in this higher reality, but we're enormously interested in understanding it. And our lives, instead of being a stupid assertion of our own ignorance against divine truth, becomes a quest to find out what's really true. And when things happen to us and we begin to suffer, instead of just shaking our fists and pointing at the world around us, we begin to ask, well, what am I doing? Why has this happened to me? How am I responsible? What can I do to change? We move into the kshatriya stage, where we become warriors, soldiers, attempting to become the king of our own inner kingdom. And that's where we all are. We waffle between the revolt and the quest. But whenever you find yourself waffling, just ask yourself, am I in a state of rebellion or am I in a state of honest inquiry? And oftentimes the way to acceptance and joy is to move into a state of honest inquiry instead of just a state of blind rebellion against what's happening in all circumstances of our lives. And a lot of it is just even in our interactions with others. People present to us realities we don't want to accept. Do we honestly ask, you know, what are you asking of me and why are you asking that? Or do we just say, no, this is the way we do things? You know, so often we just, this is the way it's always been. This is the way it always should be. I know what's right because this is the way I've always done it. You stop and ask yourself, why? You know, and if life is bringing you an alternative, no, I have to, you know, have a home for my grandchildren. I have to do this. Well, do you? You know, why? We use honest inquiry. What is really happening? What am I looking for? Why are other people asking this of me? What is the truth behind this? The quest is an all-pervasive, it's an attitude toward life. It's not just an attitude toward God. So then this last phrase then, and then we'll take a break. We now, like that little bird, have come to realize that buffeting winds are life's way of giving us strength and courage. That's a really important phrase, isn't it? That even fear, like shadows on a statue, gives light and substance to hope. It's interesting, isn't it? So life's buffeting winds are life's way of giving us strength and courage. An easy life is not necessarily a victorious one. You know, if you go to the gym and only lift the weights that you can already lift, you don't really feel that your time there has been well spent. And if you never actually are confronted with something that is bigger than you are, that frightens you, do you ever really understand the power of God's grace to overcome the substance of hope? You know, the power that God's presence is always with us. Even fear, like shadows on a statue. You know, the shadow highlights the light. And so when we go into these dark places, it allows us to discover the power of God on the other side of it. There's this wonderful story of Corey and Betsy Ten Boom, who were imprisoned in concentration camps in Holland for being Christians who helped the Jews. And Betsy died, and Corey lived, and Corey was a very saintly soul, and her sister was also a saintly soul. And before Betsy died, she said to Corey, she said, "I'm going to die, but you're going to live, and after you leave here, you're going to have to, I want you to go and preach," or "you're going to." He didn't say, "I want to." She just predicted that you will, and you'll tell people, and these were Betsy's words, that no pit is so deep, no suffering so intense, no place so dark that the love of God isn't deeper still. And then Betsy said, "And they will believe you because you've been here." And that's the fear. You know, you go really deep into these dark places, and then you discover that no matter how deep you go into the darkness, the light is always there Even underneath it all, there's no, you can't penetrate to a place where the light isn't. And we don't realize the magnitude of the hope. Into our hands have been given the sacred keys of awakening. Abundant now is our hope. You see, we're back to there. Because we have to realize that there's nothing that life can give us. There's no depth that we can sink to that God won't also be there. The hope is abundant. It's always there for us. We would only touch the surface of it if we weren't pushed by life to challenge ourselves to find those deeper senses, areas of our own nature. Well, let's take a little bit of a break and then we can come back to that. Yes, Kathy?
When you were talking about the paragraph of give yourself into my hands, to your strength I can then add my own, I kept thinking about during the purification ceremony when we come up and say, I seek
purification by the grace of God.
Open your heart and let God take charge.
The Master says, surrender to me and I will enter and take charge of your life. No, I was just repeating it just exactly. Well, that is exactly the same thing, isn't it? Yeah, it's just, you just keep coming. Tricia said during the break that the festival is really about fear and faith. And then the capacity to accept and surrender and cooperate once you, because it's also interesting, surrender to me and your strength will be renewed. To your strength I can add my own. Again, it never goes passive. It never says surrender to me and I'll do all the work for you. It says surrender to me and you'll be saved. None of that. It just says and I'll add my strength to yours. That's Master's prayer. I will reason, I will act, I will, but guide thou my reason, will, and activity to the right path and everything. And so that's, again, these are these subtleties that are sort of woven in here. What happens if you surrender? You're not saved. It's just that he'll help you. That's real different. It's very, very different than many other versions of how you work with grace that are there.
Surrender is, it's a different surrender. Often I think of, Christian, typical Christian surrender thing, it's very passive and easy and you just surrender. It's not a deeply thought out, considered step by step. You know, it might be for some people, but generally the impression I have is it's a kind of a...
Well, it's not so much a question of whether people are sincere in doing it. It's a question of their understanding of how God will respond to that. And what your personal responsibility is and how you work with it. I mean, true devotees of all faiths, even narrow faiths, behave the same way. Because they're inspired, generally, genuinely inspired by the Spirit. But here, the theology or the basic concept you're working with is that surrender merely empowers, gives you God-given power to keep on with what it is that you have to do. Instead of teaching you that you need to become passive at that point. Because there's some that's presumptuous. It's presumptuous to keep on with self-effort. Whereas in this teaching, you must keep on with self-effort. But but God's strength will be added to yours if you cooperate with it. Is that fair enough? James?
As a storyline that just spans our entire history, it just seems astounding that ignorance can be so profoundly programmed into us that... We just don't get it. That we literally don't heed the counsel until we're utterly exhausted and have virtually no other choice.
Odd, isn't it?
We learn, we learn from something or someone, whether it's ego or not. We learn this behavior of resistance. And, as you say, wisdom does not necessarily come to us, though repeatedly we lose and lose. And it's almost always, if you look around, people getting to where they are just absolutely exhausted before they just give up because there's nothing else to do.
And that is exactly how it works. And that is just the extraordinary mystery of human life. But even Master... In Autobiography of a Yogi, Master says, I have an argument with my Divine Mother. Why must you teach your children through suffering? And if I always have, when I read that, I think it's an autobiography, maybe it's in the essence of self-realization. It's in the autobiography, isn't it? It's just like if Master himself says that, and of course he's echoing our thoughts because he's one with Divine Mother. He knows. But Swami's only answer to just what you're saying is all those who have realized God no longer complain. They just see that it was the way it was meant to be and that there's no injustice in it. But the peculiarity of it is the extraordinary cleverness of human ego. But on the other side of it, Master says once it's gone, it's gone. I mean, specifically, even here's a specific example. When Swami talked to Master about the delusion of the attraction to the opposite sex, of sexual attraction, of romantic attraction, Master says, it's the greatest delusion there is, but once you're outside of it, you cannot imagine why it would ever have attracted you. You just can't even imagine why it would have attracted you. So the only thing I can think of is all the things that we're no longer attracted to do. But then you come back to why.
The people who are, you know, pointed out to us as those who follow leaders or whomever they may be.
Spiritual leaders or worldly leaders? Both.
Primarily world leaders. Or people that are just, that we look up to in our education.
Oh, okay.
That we learn about to emulate.
In worldly education you're talking about.
And that's what education tends to be. Mm-hmm. And that's what I mean. It's astounding because the storyline is just so monotonous that we would continue to be taught to look up to these people who really don't get it either.
Well, that's just when I was a little child. That was just so confusing to me. Everybody wanted me to become one of those people. And somehow, instinctively, I could see that they weren't happy. And I kept sort of like... From a very tiny child, I really wanted to be happy. Now, of course, everyone wants to be happy, but for me, it had a different quality to it, which is that I only wanted to be happy. And I was extremely conscious of the fact that so many of the things that people suggested to me that would make me happy would not make me happy. And I couldn't understand why they didn't see that. It was very confusing to me. And I also realized, as I grew a little older, that my desire for happiness was qualitatively different than many people's because I perceived it as something that I would have to generate and that I would have to constantly amend myself in order to be happy. That it was about my own desires and being at peace with myself and things like that. But otherwise, it's this... The incredible one that I realized was how many married people are very unhappy and how many of those married people are so excited when someone else gets married. Misery loves company. One particular scene that I witnessed was this couple who just were embarrassingly antagonistic toward each other, you know, 35 or a 50-year marriage kind of, maybe not that long because the children were just getting married, but embarrassingly antagonistic. But, you know, they would squabble in the most unattractive way, and then she would turn around and gush over her daughter's wedding. And I just kept thinking, this is so weird. It was just so weird to me. I couldn't put my mind around it. Why, James? God knows. Because of Satan. That's what you have to say. I like Maya better. Because of Maya, because this weird delusion comes over our minds. And that's what we're doing battle with. That's the fear and weakness that we're conquering, is this fear and weakness imposed by Maya. Why? But anguishing, you use the word monotonous too. That's Master's words. Certain, after a while, all this reincarnation assumes a certain anguishing monotony. Because you see, even tragedy is absorbing. It's really the monotony that finally causes you to get to just get desperately to get out. Yes?
It just seems so clear to me that part of grasping the truth behind these words is where we are karmically. Because when I was 20, a spiritual teacher said this exact thing to me, and I got it, but I didn't get it like I do now.
Mm-hmm.
And many more lifetimes, I'll have it even stronger.
Right.
But it's just, so much of this has to be karma.
Well, that's where it says right here. Let's see. Afternoon came. Night fell. And that's saying exactly what you're saying, which is you start out in the morning and it looks a certain way. Then you reach afternoon and it looks a certain way. Then you reach night in a certain way. That's why it's foolish to try to persuade people. I when I was first onto the spiritual path, I don't know why, but we all fall for this. We just get so enamored of this idea that desires are the great enemy, and that, you know, if we just overcome desires, that we'll be free. And somehow the newbie always thinks this is a very magnetic concept. And I was a quintessential newbie, and I was talking to a relative of mine, and I was trying to convert her, and I started right in by talking about how, you know, desires are so disappointing, and we long for things, and then when we finally acquire them, they just don't give us what we think they're going to give us. And she was so with me, you know, she was nodding her head, and she was affirming and adding her little bit, and we're just going right along, and I think, oh, this is my first convert, you know. And we're just right there, and we're agreeing that you know, you're so disappointed once you get things, it doesn't do it for you. And she says, that's why it's so important to keep on wanting new things. That was how she'd worked it out. There you have it, James. You know, Master says that's Satan. Master gives a very inspired explanation of Satan. That if life totally didn't work, you would reject it quickly. But what Satan does is he makes it almost work. And so you feel like you were just so close that if you just shifted it a little. And so then you reincarnate because you were so close. I mean, you had everything except, you know, you were married to the wrong person, or your wife was barren and you didn't get to have children, or you made that wrong investment, or you got into the wrong career, family, everything was wonderful, but you had the wrong career. Just some little tiny change. So we'll just do the whole thing again, but we'll just make that little tiny change. So you make that little tiny change, and then it's just almost perfect, except there's something over here.
So we have all the population around us that reinforces that behavior.
Yep, because of the yuga. You see, because this is Kali Yuga ending, Dwapara starting. If we had the karma to be on a Satya Yuga planet, the planet would be affirming spirituality. If we lived in India in a golden age, it would be affirming it. You know, but right now, yeah, we've chosen to put ourselves in stark contrast because we have a job to do. Yep. Any other comments, or shall we? Let's see what happens next. Then we say, we've gotten the bird through its little story, so we say, from the depths of unknowing, Lord, we cry out to thee. And we say, is there no lasting purpose to our lives? This is what you're saying. We've just been playing this game for a really long time. Is there no lasting purpose, something that endures more than this? Behold, all that we thought was light was what but darkness. What is night to the worldly man is day to the yogi. What is day to the worldly man is night to the yogi. James, you followed the story right into the next chapter, which is all of a sudden we're looking around. All that we thought was going to work for us doesn't work for us. Who are we in reality? For what end were we made? Now, as you see, these are all now, we have really walked into the quest. Okay, I was doing it this certain way. I thought it was going to work. It seemed like it was going to work. All these principles I had in place, I was going to have the right job. Somebody said to me recently, it was so poignant, I was raised to think, you know, that if you just behaved, it would all work out. I said, well, somebody made a promise to you that was a lie. You know, they didn't have the power to promise you that it would all work out. It was just very, very presumptuous and wrong of them. I remember I was talking to my nephew, and he was lamenting some, you know, big thing that the world was doing to him. And, you know, I just looked at him for a minute, and, you know, I just wanted to say, that's life, honey. And in a slightly kinder way than that, that's just what I said. Because there was nothing I could tell him that would make it okay. What he was facing was just what you face. I said, well, you're just going to have to, you know, find inner resources to deal with it, kid. And then we started talking about that, but that is the answer. There is no answer, and it's better not to lie, even to children. Just tell them the truth. You know, whatever, all that I thought was light was but darkness. Who are we in reality? For what end were we made? And I love this. Ever and again through your awakened sons, the answer comes. As soon as you ask that question, and the awakened sons, of course, this is the return of the masters. And you see again how the subtle teaching is here. The devotee asks the question, what is going on? And the answer is, ever and again, through your awakened sons, the answer comes. There are souls who do understand, and they return to this earth over and over to whatever planet anybody is on, and they'll tell you again and again. And it's ongoing. And this relates back to that the light has descended anew, because ever and again the light comes, and now the light has descended anew. And then we have this, another one of these poetic stories. And this is the answer. You see, this is a colon. Ever and again, through your awakened sons, the answer comes, colon. And then here is the answer. You don't get that one until you see the punctuation on it. The forming of stars and moons and planets, of galaxies revolving on the tides of space, of drifting continents, upheaving mountains, snowy wastes and dark, silent ocean deeps, had but this for its design, the birth of life. And with life's birth, the dawn of self-awareness. Passage through dim corridors of waking consciousness to emerge at last into infinite light, into perfect joy. Now, this is sort of the divine answer. As soon as we're born, as soon as creation is made, it's all moving in this wonderful symphony through many stages of unconsciousness into ever greater stages of consciousness until we emerge into infinite light and infinite joy. And this is what it looks like from the point of view of a master. When they look at it, it doesn't look to them like all of the suffering and sorrow and confusion. It just looks like all of creation moving into the infinite. And that's why the masters don't complain. You say, we're the waves. And we think all these waves going up and down, and we're so upset about these waves. But when we finally get it from the perspective of the ocean, you just see that all it is the huge ocean just rolling into the infinite. And of course it goes in undulating waves, but that's how it moves. But your sense of reality shifts. And you realize that the waves were never happening. That's why the complaint isn't there. But it was just a dream. It was just so temporary. All that was ever happening is everything that was created was born to go into infinity. And this is what we have to affirm this very powerfully in ourselves. I know Jyotish once gave a sermon that was so dear about the statement of Jesus, "For this hour was I born." And you know, it's so powerful. He's about to be crucified and redeem the whole world with his sacrifice. "For this hour was I born." But then Jyotish pointed out that all of us can say that. Exactly the moment that you're standing in, you know, sitting there having a tofu sandwich in the restaurant. "For this hour were you born." The entire culmination of all of your incarnations has come to a focus right in this moment. I mean, it's embarrassing sometimes, isn't it? But this is what this passage is about. The forming of stars and moons, of planets, of galaxies revolving on the tides of space, passage through dim corridors of waking consciousness to emerge at last into infinite light. That's us. Isn't that exciting? We're just part of this great, you know, majestic force of creation moving into the infinite. And, you know, we're just too tired to get up and meditate. I mean, I slept through meditation this morning. I mean, that was just... Isn't that a joke? All that we thought was light was with darkness. It's so funny. But in time. And then the light bearer says with great power, "Oh, children of light, forsake the darkness." You know, like, okay, get over it. Let's get on with the program. And it's meant to be like that. Now we've taken the bird through all these stages of revolt and confusion, and now he's into the quest, and now he's ready, and the awakened sons have come, and they've given us the answer, and we're all going to the infinite light. Okay, let's do it. And this, you know, we don't do it that dramatically, but the words are that dramatic, aren't they? And then everybody rises, and we sing this fantastic Thunder of Om song. You know, sometimes people sing it like it's meant to be sung with that kind of power. But it's meant to be the announcement of this great realization that we've all come to, that we celebrate together. So then we raise our hands and ask the power of God to replenish us in body, mind, and soul. One Sunday, David said, that God refurbish us in body, mind, and soul. it struck us both as so funny, we almost couldn't go on. That was one of the hardest times. I saw the little upholsterers coming in, you know, taking the stains out of the little karmic rug. Just, but anyway, we've never actually done the one that other people have done, which is children of darkness, forsake the light. A surprising number of people have actually said that at service. Okay, we thought we would close. Joe has strapped his guitar on. We'll sing the Om song, okay? But let's just sort of read it for a moment. Out of the silence came the song of creation. Out of the darkness came the light. Out of the darkness, out of the silence, thundered the cosmic sound. Amen. Out of the darkness, out of the silence, thundered the cosmic sound. Om. Gone is our bondage with the dawn of new freedom. Gone is delusion in the light. Isn't this a powerful song? You know, and then it's gone is delusion, gone is your bondage. And then it's in the present tense, thunders the cosmic sound, om. People don't always catch that. In other words, you hear the om, and the om tells you that delusion is gone. All your bondage is gone. How do you overcome fear and weakness? You look to the source of all power. Where do I find that source? In the farthest depths of being, in your own self. What do you find when you go into your own self? You find the om. What does the om tell you? Gone is your delusion. Gone is your bondage. That's what the om sound tells you. See how beautifully it fits together? And then we sing it again and again. Okay, so why don't we sing this? Yes, Steve.
I just wanted to know about the clapping with this song.
Right. I always see Swami clapping, and I've often wondered, why does he clap? But I think he's, in his way, he's just trying to set the example. You know, I mean, he'll clap inaudibly, but if you watch, he almost always claps when it's done. And I was watching him do that, and I think, well, I think it's, you know, just to at least to encourage people to become engaged. And I think it's probably just to become engaged, and, you know, it's such an odd and rhythmical song, I mean, odd in the sense of, but you can see, this is the point in which we all stand up and really affirm. This is children of light forsake the darkness, and then we sing this strongly affirmative song about the om, and so, you know, anything that would encourage it. I mean, I get to watch everybody, you know, people who are newer tend to kind of dance like this. You know, they kind of catch the rhythm in that way. Oh, I just figure whatever works, it doesn't matter. Why should I stop them? People who are brand new kind of feel at home suddenly. Because they've got something to relate to with a little beat.
You know,
yeah?
Sometimes over the years, you hear it played more or less more powerfully also.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes the music is, you know, how powerful the music is actually played will...
But it's mostly the congregation having done this, you know, I don't know how many times, but certainly hundreds. It's just the mood of this room or whatever room we're in. And I mean, sometimes it can start over here where the musicians and the choir are. If they're particularly on, sometimes they'll pick up the room. But it's really the whole place. Patrick has threatened I think he only did it once, but he wanted to like have little tutorials in the middle of Sunday service to really get people to actually sing these songs. But I notice that sometimes it's there. And when, you know, once it starts, everybody gets into it. And yes, of course, it does help. If the musicians have really got it, it really does help. But it's not just their fault. Okay? Okay, should we do it?
But, especially
well, there were 450 people there. That has a strong effect. And they were all, oh yeah, the music on Sunday, this last Sunday when Swami was speaking, the whole temple was filled and the whole dining room was filled. There were 450 people there. They counted it. I mean, and people just, whoom, gave it everything they had. And, yeah, that's how it's meant to be played. They had three guitarists. I also noticed the guitarists were extremely centered. They were playing really well, but they weren't, none of their energy was going anywhere except just into the music. It was very, I mean, not that, I don't mean to put you on the spot. I mean, because sometimes people play, you know, play very well with a lot of feeling and they use their bodies a lot more in it. But it was just interesting. They were all just very, absolutely still, except for what was going on in their hands. So if we're going to sing, though, we have to come closer. We have to be like a choir. We can't be like this 9 feet of space. Pardon me?
I need you to share your stand.
Well, I'm not going to. Okay. Can you? You. Can I give him the microphone? Can I put the microphone in here?
Do we need the mic?
Actually, if you just leave the mic on yourself, Asha.
Yeah, pick it up.
Okay. It won't work unless I exercise a small amount of intelligence at the same time. Okay, let's do it.
the silence came the song of creation. Out of the darkness came the light. Out of the silence came the sound of creation. Out of the darkness came the light. Out of the darkness, out of the silence, thundered the cosmic sound of God. Out of the darkness, out of the silence, thundered the cosmic sound of God.
That'll do it for tonight. Unless somebody has any questions or comments. Otherwise, see you next week for the last class.